Father Gonzalo Ituarte. I'm really pleased to introduce him. We've been friends for a long, long time. He is a Dominican friar and priest, and he is the prior provincial, the head of the Dominican Order for Mexico. He was formerly in charge of the Dominican mission to Ocosingo in Mexico, in the state of Chiapas, where he worked very closely with the late Don Samuel Ruiz Garcia, Bishop Samuel Ruiz, who was a pioneer of social justice and a great champion of the indigenous people of Mexico, the Maya people of Mexico. Father Gonzalo served him as his Episcopal vicar for peace and justice in the Diocese of San Cristobal de las Casas. And he himself was very much involved in the negotiation and peacemaking between the Mexican government and the Zapatista rebels in the state of Chiapas. And so Gonzalo is a veteran of the struggle for peace and justice, and he is a member of the Peace Council. Began as a Peace Council trustee, and as we say, we kicked him upstairs and made him a peace counselor. And so we're really pleased to have him here today.
Well, thanks. So why don't we just move right into our conversation today, actually asking Father Gonzalo the question that you've been asking each peace counselor since we began.
And that is that, Gonzalo, you've been with the Peace Council just about since its beginning in 1995. And can you recall an experience with the group? We've been asking everyone this just to give people a better understanding of what this remarkable organization is and the experiences that people have come to treasure. Can you recall an experience with the group that was particularly meaningful to you?
Yes, of course, the founding session, being from Mexico, which is a mostly Catholic country, and with not much experience in relation with other religions, some Christian churches are present, but basically to go into Windsor Castle and find so many people from so different religions, so different cultures and races, and being together and looking for peace and sharing from a very open heart in the struggle for the good for the people was a discovery for me, was a growth for my own life, and was the best way to understand really what to be a Christian for me is, because we used to think that we Catholics had the truth and all people should become Catholic or at least Christian to have real life. And there I discovered that being together with all these religions means to find what God wills in this variety, in this kaleidoscopic view of humanity, and that is a real reflection of God. And that is a gift for me when I was invited to the founding session. And then, of course, the presence of the Peace Council in Chiapas, in the midst of the negotiations between the Zapatista army and the Mexican government, to have the energy of all religions from most significant in the world and bringing together so many people in the Cathedral of San Cristobal to pray for peace from so many languages and from so many perspectives is something that I will treasure all my life.
I should just say, for those who don't know this, that the first meeting of the Peace Council was held at Windsor Castle. It was the first time that a non-royal group was ever invited to hold a meeting there. We were there for about a week, and then the first real gathering of the Peace Council in an area of conflict and strife was in Chiapas at the invitation of Bishop Ruiz and of Gonzalo Ituarte, and it was something I think none of us will ever forget. Well, Father Gonzalo, I want to begin with and get us to the topic that we're going to talk about mostly today, and we'd like to explore two profoundly interrelated issues that are both vitally tied to conflict and therefore to peace building, and I'm talking about poverty and migration. And you've worked very closely with communities in Mexico in particular that have been very strongly affected by both realities, by poverty and by migration. And can you just reflect a little bit more about the phenomenon of massive migration which is often driven by chronic poverty. What is the connection between the two, and why is it so important to understand them if we want to be peacemakers?
Well, of course, poverty as a result of unjust society, of injustice, is something that destroys life and is a violence in itself. And of course, since the people from their hearts want to live, want to have life, they look for different ways. Many times they try in their own land, in their own places, and then they look out. They look for somewhere else where they can achieve the minimum of dignity and life to develop their persons and their families. And both are phenomena, poverty and migration, that have a negative and a positive aspect, many. Of course, in itself, poverty means something negative, some lacking of something that is needed. And migration means breaking from their roots and their land, their culture, and taking the adventure in a different environment, which usually is adverse, is negative. And so there's no peace in that kind of aspects of poverty and migration. But also poverty in many cultures and environments sometimes becomes a positive element, because brings together the people. People in need are more open to tend their hands, to get together and to find ways to build the new life in support of each other. Usually, when we don't have personal needs, it's not that easy to break our world and open ourselves to the others. And migration has the same. Migration is also a very positive event in humanity. In fact, humanity is a migrant entity. All human beings come from migration from all over the world and always looking for better life. And migrants bring new perspectives, new energies, new creativity to the local societies that receive them, and then send back to their own countries or places very positive issues. So both are peace-building elements, and at the same time are denial of peace.
I think it's interesting also to point out for folks that are thinking about this for the first time, although I think most of the people on this call would be very familiar with these two issues, but there's a new consciousness, isn't there, in international development circles and people who work for justice about the relationship between poverty and migration. I'm hearing much more in the way of conferences and conversations about the profound interconnection of these two. Is that your experience as well?
Yes, of course. In Chiapas, which is the place where I really got in touch with poverty, local poverty, and then I found the people looking for alternatives to go and come back, to go and come back to some certain areas close in, within Mexico. But the last 10 years, lots of people from the indigenous communities of Chiapas have gone to the United States in the hope of finding some better opportunities, because Mexico itself has been through an economic crisis that doesn't offer much opportunities. And now the situation in the U.S. is also closing possibilities. But poverty makes people look for better alternatives because they love their people. They want to have, not only for themselves personally, but for their families and their communities, especially when they come from a culture that is so communal-oriented, yeah, and they move eager to find something that will respond to their great needs. They have a deep aspiration to life, to live, and they take the risk of getting out of their area of security in their cultures and language, and then take the risk to go through thousands of kilometers to look for life. And that is something that is Well, very, very much related, poverty and migration.
It occurs to me just now to ask, because we're going through this sort of convulsion in the United States with a very strong opposition coming from the political right, from the right wing, opposition to immigration and deep concern about immigration. And it just occurs to me that we have an opportunity here with you to ask how that feels from the other side. I'm sure there's a lot of awareness in Mexico, not just among the communities of the poorer, but nationwide, must be some real intense awareness of this new attitude from certain political circles in the United States. How does that feel from your side?
It's something that really surprises us, because the U.S. has been always presented to ourselves as the melting pot and the place where there was opportunity for all and a very open society in large periods of history, and the fact that we have many, many Mexicans living there and many Latino people there. Has shown that, and we feel that the U.S. is committing suicide in self-defense, trying to get rid or not in letting bring the entering new life, new people, new energy, new work, new creativity. In fact, is weakening the United States. It's something that seems absurd. But we feel that it is like a suicide in self-defense, and that is bringing a lot of suffering also for those people who do need an opportunity.
And when we talk about the situation of poverty, not just in Mexico, but let's say also in Central and South America, is there any real improvement? What does the situation look like today, and what does the future look like? I'd like you to think about that, and also think about what are some of the most promising efforts on dealing with poverty and distress of that sort. What are some of the most promising efforts, and also, if you don't mind, what are some of the forces that obstruct positive change? So that's a big question, but what's happening on the poverty front in Central and South America as well as in Mexico?
Well, I think that brings us to the global system, global economic system. In fact, when we had the big crisis created by the big economic financial institutions of the world, and especially of the U.S., we thought that was a great opportunity, that there will be a deep change in the economic policies and the economic system in the world. And so there was great expectation, and of course, there are many local initiatives to struggle against poverty and find new ways, but we depend every day more of the global system, and we have been disappointed to find that humanity doesn't seem to have learned enough of this economic crisis that we went through, and the same criteria, the same volume, the same interests are still leading the economics in the world, and of course in Latin America. But the growth, local growth of consciousness and self-awareness of the possibilities within, and the efforts being done in Latin America in particular, looking for alternatives, although it's very slow process and very complex, because it's not an easy challenge to find an alternative to capitalism in the way it is known today. But still, people are looking for, people are having meetings, studying, discovering through history the possibilities of alternatives, looking in the traditional cultures to see if from there we can find new ways by which we could overcome poverty. But in fact, the big economic crisis that we just suffered all over the world increased the number of people in poverty, in extreme poverty, particularly in Mexico. Some other countries were more fortunate in their facing the crisis. But it's the promising elements are, or efforts, are in the interrelation of groups and peoples in Mexico and Central America and Latin America to find alternatives from their own tradition and reality and situation, and less expecting from outside. Also, although we need support, we need to work together. It's impossible to have any local solution without a global approach.
And I suppose when you talk about the global systemic factors, those are the prime obstructions to progress.
Yes, for sure. And the fact that we were not able to overcome that kind of situation through the crisis created by that system itself.
And I think it's really interesting that you say the disappointment that comes when it becomes apparent that we really haven't learned the economic and financial lessons that one would have expected the world to learn.
Yes, very much so. And you phrased it properly.
Well, on a sadder note, the Peace Council recently lost a founding member, and we all lost a friend, and you lost a mentor with the death of Bishop Samuel Ruiz Garcia. I wonder if you could tell us all just a little bit about this great man and what he meant to you and to the indigenous people of Chiapas and Mexico. And I think it connects very directly with this business of poverty and migration.
Yes, of course. Bishop Samuel Ruiz was appointed Bishop of Chiapas in 1960, before the big changes of the Catholic Church through the Vatican Council. And when he approached that reality, coming from a different part of Mexico, the discovery of the indigenous people immediately made him feel sad and full of mercy, and wanted to help them and wanted to bring things to give them what he thought would be the best. But it didn't take too much time. Because of his closeness to the people, he began to be a disciple of the indigenous people, learning from them instead of imposing on them his own perspective. And then with the evolution of the thinking of the Catholic Church and the approach from the perspective of the option of the poor, Don Samuel Ruiz became a very close to the people and began to realize that the only way the indigenous people would be freed from their almost slavery that they were suffering was that they would be the ones who would decide their own lives. We say in Spanish, sujetos de su propia historia, subjects of their own history. I don't know if that is clear in English,
it's
but that
clear.
Is the idea that they would be lead their lives instead of depending on the white Spanish-speaking people. And Don Samuel understood his function as a bishop, Catholic bishop, and his preaching of the gospel as something that takes the whole of life, not only the spiritual aspect, or as it used to happen, to think of after death. He said always that the kingdom of God should happen here, or else it won't happen anywhere. And then, so we have to build peace, justice, life in this world. And he was able to do this because he listened to the people, and also because he found that he could not do anything by himself. And he invited many people to join in a large team that through the years became very strong in serving the interests of the indigenous peoples, in recovering the values, the culture, their identity, even their religious perspectives that have been lost because of the imposition of the Catholic teaching, and then building together something for the present and the future. Don Samuel was really a mentor for me and for many because he was converted by the Indians. He came to Chiapas thinking of converting the indigenous people to the real Catholic faith, and he found himself being led by the Indians to be converted to Christ, who for him and for me as Catholics and Christians is so the central, the most meaningful manifestation of God in history.
When we're talking about the indigenous people, of course, in the case of the state of Chiapas, we're talking about the Maya people. And just one last note, I was always really moved by the fact that the Maya people of Chiapas spoke of Don Samuel in their own language, and they called him Tatik. What does that mean, and what does that tell us about their affection for him?
Well, strictly, Tatik means our father, and it's a very strong expression. They don't call Tatik any priest, or very few people are called Tatik by the Indians, because that's really establishing a spiritual relation of love and confidence and trust. Don Samuel was someone really trusted by the indigenous people and loved because he gave himself for the indigenous people. So the response was this title, I don't know how to say. And even in his last moment, when he was buried in the cathedral a month ago, people were feeling that their father had died, but at the same time that their father had given them so much that he is really alive in the struggle of the people.
That's really something. I wonder if you'd reflect a little bit on another struggle that you've been involved in, and something we've been talking about in these conversations with peace counselors, the struggle between religious fundamentalism on the one side and religious pluralism. And I've been asking each of our participants whether they, as they look on the world, whether they see religious fundamentalism as the likelier future or religious pluralism. And I will tell you, without shaping your answer, that all of our participants so far have been hopeful, at least, that what we're looking for is the spread of religious pluralism. But that's particularly complex when we talk about Latin America. It's complex enough in the world at large. How do you reflect on all of that, fundamentalism or pluralism, as the real evolutionary wave of the future?
Yeah, in fact, I'm optimistic by heart, by belief, by personality, and I do hope that pluralism will be the face of humanity in the future. But I do realize that the challenge of overcoming this fundamentalism that happens not only in specific traditions, but within, in my case, in Catholic Church, we have a very strong fundamentalism in sectors of the Catholic Church, and also people very open to religious pluralism. So it's something that we have to struggle all the time. And especially in according to periods of time when there is economic difficulties or even military confrontations or violence. In Mexico now, the violence is coming more from the drug struggle and all that. But the experience of Mexico has been of different groups amongst Christianity, within Christianity, amongst Christian denominations, some fundamentalistic, some pluralistic, some open to dialogue, some open to the possibility of sharing the same place and world and build together. So I think that the result of all these difficult years in which we had many confrontations in Chiapas, after the war in Central America, many small groups of evangelical, charismatic groups, even Catholic charismatic, made their presence in Chiapas, and it was a very difficult time, a great tension, division in the communities and all that. But we are learning that plurality, that it's a result of human evolution, and it's the result of respecting and discovering the richness of the other person's dignity and life and rights, and that has to grow. We have to work hard to make it possible. But I do believe that the future has to be pluralistic. The only way each religion will fulfill its own mission is listening and discovering the richness of the others, and then coming together to face, for example, poverty, which has brought together many people from many parts of the world in the struggle for to overcome war, poverty, injustice.
Well, that leads right into another question that we've been exploring in different ways with each of our callers, sort of as part of the background of this series of conversations, is the notion that we might very well be living in an age of dramatic acceleration of cultural evolution. And we've talked about that in a variety of ways. And the possibility that in this age of cultural evolutionary value shift, we might be witnessing a progressive change, a change for the better. And so in these conversations, we've talked on new approaches to peace and justice, deepening sense of the sacredness of the earth and all life. We've talked about, of course, the growth of religious pluralism. We've talked a bit about new movements to safeguard the common heritage of all humankind, the earth, the air, the water, culture, and so on. I know, as you say, I've known for many years that you are an optimist or a hopeful person at heart. That's a pretty hopeful array. How do you feel about all of that? Are you a believer in cultural evolution? Do we get wiser? Do we get better? And is there something special about this time in which we find ourselves?
Well, I do have the conviction that that is happening, that we are witnessing this evolution, especially when finding young people who have been taught through the media, through the all this consumerism, have been taught to be autistic, to be self-centered, to be looking for their own good only, and then to find people who reject that vision, young people who want to really be free from that slavery produced by consumerism and obsession for having things, and people who want to be more human than rich economically. So there are signs, of course, and I do believe that it's like small seeds that we are planting and or we are witnessing the growth. But I'm aware also that it's a great challenge, because the dominant culture, global culture, produced by the mass media, and now with all this technology, internet and all that, that really creates a culture in the people. People are, from childhood, what they will, they are babies, they are beginning to be bombed by all this ideology, by all this lack of values and obsession for certain aspects of a certain vision of human being, very poor, very narrow, very self-centered. And to overcome that, it's a very great challenge, because very strong economic and political interests are behind this global culture. And at the same time, the means of the global official culture, let's say, are being used by the alternative. We are using internet and all these marvelous technological achievements of humanity also to build the alternative. What we have seen in Africa now, in Egypt and all that, is showing that it is possible to change, that it is, there are many interests that try not to allow this change because it's not good for their business, but for the business of being human, it's extremely important that we do believe in the future and we build together through small seeds the possibilities of a new kind of human life with new consciousness and awareness of our interdependence and our unity in a way with nature, which is basic for our survival as humanity.
Well, you touch on something that's a favorite topic of mine as you contrast what you could call globalization from the top down, and that's that media-driven culture of acquisitiveness and greed and ideological narrowness and so on that you described. But then you also talk about the hopeful signs in terms of what I would often call globalization from the bottom up, as there's a real spread, a new global consensus of values that have to do with peace and justice and ecological sustainability. And we see that developing from the ground up. You talked about efforts in Africa, in Mexico, and so on. I like that contrast between the top-down that most people think is simply defining the future, but the bottom-up, the emerging cultures of values, I think that holds tremendous promise, don't you?
That's a real promise, because that's the only thing that will change at the end the world. It's from the small, from the little, from the poor, from the weak, that comes the hope. Those who feel strong, secure, self-sufficient, and with the right to dominate the others are necessarily wrong, and someday they will hopefully discover that and change their mind. But meanwhile, we have to learn to be critical of this system and experience freedom, and then share that, and especially with the new generations, which are very deeply conditioned by this global culture from upside down, and to make them builders of the alternative.
Well, as we come to the end of our allotted time, I have one more question I'd like to ask you. Most of the listeners on this call are personally engaged, as I've told you before, in peace and justice work on the local level, or on the regional level, or even on the global level. And I think many of us regularly confront the realities of local and regional and global poverty and the loss of hope that often comes with that. And I wonder if you'd, since we've been talking about the emergence of new values from the bottom up, and we have implicitly, it seems to me, been invoking the idea of spiritual commitment, especially when we spoke, for example, about Don Samuel Ruiz. I wonder if you'd have a word or two of spiritual encouragement for all of those, all of us who would like to be of service to each other and to the world.
Well, yes, it comes to my mind immediately, my first experience in touch with the indigenous people, when I discovered all those extremely poor persons without any possibility of communication in Spanish and very visibly sick, many of them dying before time. For them to be 50 years old was to be a very old person or things like that. And I found a contrast. Being in such poverty, they were hopeful, they were joyful, they were generous, they were eager to share and happy even to dance when we visited them with Bishop Samuel. That was a shocking experience for me, and discovered that even from that poverty that for me was a disgrace, was a very negative thing that was happening of these people, they were so deeply human and warm and generous in sharing and smiling at the future and full of trust, that I was freed. And they allowed me to understand poverty in different perspectives. Of course, we will never accept imposed poverty, but the freedom that many poor people experience is something that they gave me. And I enjoyed life, and my own faith was transformed in touch with the poor. I think that in the poor is the hope of humanity, and since all our friends listening to this conversation are committed in this, I'm sure they can witness to this, and from the poor and with the poor we will be able to build a better world in which there might not be too much wealth, but there will be much more spirit and dignity and friendship and relationship and plurality.
Well, I think that's an incredible note to end on. We thank you very much, Gonzalo.
Thank you.